content information for this episode. It contains themes of sexual and physical violence. Hey, Martin.
Hey, Christina.
Have you ever been elected the president of anything really important? For example, the American Psychological Association?
Something really important? No. I was elected president of a club I made up as a grad student.
Was it the Martin Psychological Association, the MPA?
It should have been. Wow. It would have been less stressful running for president then if it was my club. It was a student rhetoric society club, and I got elected president of that. Yeah. Sounds pretty great, right? Yeah. So not terribly prestigious, as you can imagine.
I can't even imagine the speeches you would give to a rhetoric society to get elected. That's incredible.
Yeah, there was a lot of reference to the story of Corax and Tisias, which is an ancient Greek myth about the origins of rhetoric and taking people to court for not teaching you how to speak properly.
We also had
very long conversations about what sorts of parliamentary procedures we should use.
No. I'm shutting this down. I can't know about the inner workings of the rhetoric society.
Yeah.
No. Do you think the main thing preventing you from being elected president of the American Psychological Association is that you never psychologically tortured some 20-year-olds one summer?
Mm. Yeah. I imagine those 20-year-olds I tortured that summer would prevent me from becoming the president of the APA.
No. They would get you elected to be the president of the APA.
Oh, yeah. Well, so it's a good thing I was joking about torturing those 20-year-olds then, because I think you're entirely correct that my failure to torture a bunch of 20-year-olds is exactly what prevented me from becoming the president of the APA.
Do you want to hear the story about one of the presidents of the APA and his wonderful, wonderful research that he did?
I'd love to hear about that. Theme song?
Theme song! Do you want to tell the people who we are?
Yeah, all right. Intro time. Hey, everyone. Welcome to They Did What to What? An internet podcast that's like a journal club, except you didn't do the reading. Instead, Christina and I discuss classic articles from psychology that tell us how we think about how we think. Most of these articles are horrifying in some way, most of them because they're historical. This one is too recent to be this bad.
That should be a little stamp that we have that we can stamp onto the article. Yeah. Too recent to be this bad.
Yeah.
So today we're talking about the Stanford Prison Experiment. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the Stanford Prison Experiment?
Oh, totally. Yeah. So obviously this one came up in multiple psychology classes I took. We heard about it in Intro to Psychology. We heard about it in Social Psychology. We heard about it in the Research Methods class, I imagine. And I know I heard about it in the kind of classic Studies in Psychology course that I took. So I heard about this several times.
I genuinely have no memory of ever in an official context learning about the Stanford Prison Experiment.
Okay.
It's one of those memories that I have that has just, it's just like foundational knowledge. The knowledge has always been there. There's no formation memory.
Right.
The memory was implanted from birth of this experiment happened. This experiment took place. It was fucking weird. Weird, 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 weird.
Well, so
weird stuff.
So the only details I actually remember are from that classic studies course. And this is because I remember watching, I want to say like video footage that the experimenter took. And so we watched that. But other than that, I just know that we talked about it. I don't remember any details because like you, I think I already knew about the basics of the study before it came up.
Old hat. Everyone knows
it.
When you're born, the doctor slaps you to make sure that you're breathing. Yep. And then he takes you to a room to say, okay, here's the foundation of psychology. Here's how you will be evaluated.
Yeah.
And then the doctor gives you back to, yeah.
No, that sounds right.
So I have to do like a tiny rant at the very top.
Okay.
I genuinely struggled and I canceled recording this multiple times because I had no idea how to research this. Yeah. This is the most convoluted. This is the most complex. This is the most across decades. This is the most bizarre. This has simultaneously the most and the least foundational work.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's very, very strange. So I started trying to find like, what do I even present for the podcast? Right. What do I talk about for the podcast? Right. Stanford University has a website about the Stanford Prison Experiment.
I remember that.
But
yeah.
They only give you access to the articles if you're a Stanford student. I am not a Stanford student. So you can click on the pages and you can see the titles of the articles, but then you have to log in with your Stanford student account.
Oh, really?
They also have the videos on there, but I didn't want to watch the videos because this experiment took place over 4 days. And one of the main points of this podcast is like a foundational understanding of what happened. And my understanding is that Philip Zimbardo, the psychologist who ran, psychologist and Stanford University professor who ran the study, had multiple cameras recording continuously for 4 days. It was like a surveillance.
Oh,
constant
right.
Surveillance.
I remember that now. Yeah.
So I didn't want to watch anything because I was like, everything that I watch is going to be edited with an agenda in mind. Everything that supports the conclusion will be included. Everything that rejects the conclusion will be rejected.
Right.
And also, the other caveat is that Philip Zimbardo didn't publish this study in the way that you're supposed to publish peer-reviewed studies.
Okay.
When you search in PubMed, Stanford Prison Experiment, the first reference to it is actually an article that someone else published that criticized the Stanford Prison Experiment because Philip Zimbardo first published effectively a report to his funding agency, which was the Navy. He was funded by the Navy.
Okay.
So the first report of the Stanford Prison Experiment is in Naval Research Reviews in 1973. The experiment was conducted in 71. So 2 years later, he made his report to his funding agency.
Okay.
And this report is not in PubMed. It's not indexed in PubMed. So I had to track down Naval Research Reviews from 1973.
Yeah.
And the article about the Stanford Prison Experiment is preceded by a profile of Dr. Walter Monk, who's a geophysicist and oceanographer.
Okay.
And then immediately following the report of the Stanford Prison Experiment is, quote, oceanography from the bottom up. So we have the Stanford Prison Experiment literally published in like an oceanography journal as the first report. And then Philip Zimbardo wrote an op-ed effectively in the New York Times, April 8th in 1973. So the first reports we get, the big like data dump, quote, data dump, is to the New York Times. Uh-huh. And that's not peer-reviewed. It's edited, but it's not peer-reviewed.
Right.
And an oceanography naval review journal. The first thing in PubMed is a criticism of the Stanford Prison Experiment.
Okay.
And that is very fitting for the study because effectively for many decades, anybody who ever says anything negative about the Stanford Prison Experiment or critical of the Stanford Prison Experiment or references the Stanford Prison Experiment gets a direct response from Philip Zimbardo. And he publishes a point-by-point, line-by-line rebuttal, effectively, of what anyone says about this experiment.
Okay.
Philip Zimbardo is still alive. He's 91 years old. He could listen to this episode and then publish something in PubMed saying, these assholes are assholes, and here's my line-by-line response of how terrible they are.
Okay, well.
And it took me forever because I was trying to figure out, like, how do I even structure this? Do I start with the criticisms?
Right.
And then work backwards to the original reports.
Right.
And when it like washed over me that the original reports aren't reports in the same way we would expect a psychological study to be reported.
Got it. Yeah.
Everything is like tinged. You know what I mean? Everything is unreliable narrator, biased narrator, selling this idea, selling this schema, basically, this philosophy.
Right. So what you're saying is that there is no originary peer-reviewed paper, that the only things that we have to work from are coming from Zimbardo, or are...
Everything comes from Zimbardo,
or are critiques or refutations of Zimbardo, all of which are... I suppose some... You said one of the first things was this kind of response to him, right?
It was a letter.
That was a letter. So even that wasn't peer-reviewed.
Right. It was like a 2-3-page letter criticizing how Zimbardo had a conflict of interest, where he was the professor deciding what the ethical outline of this study should be.
Got it. Right. But even that was not a kind of refereed study. It was a letter to a journal. Those are edited, but they're up to different levels of scrutiny.
Yeah, it's an opinion piece versus a report in that way. And over time, Philip Zimbardo has made incredible efforts of what he calls transparency, mm-hmm. where he published a book that you can go and buy and give him money called The Lucifer Effect.
Oh, right.
So you can buy The Lucifer Effect and read 600 pages. And a huge portion of that book is like day by day, event by event retelling of the Stanford prison experiment.
Oh, wow.
He's tried to make like all of the logs public, all of the reports public, everything like that. So anytime he gets a criticism saying you didn't report this, he gets to point to his book that you can buy.
Got it.
He gets to point to the website, the Stanford website that you can't really access unless you're a Stanford student.
Okay.
So it's just like everything is shrouded. There's shrouds everywhere. Shroud over here, shroud over there. It's all
amazing.
Shrouded, right?
Yeah. So what did you end up focusing on for this?
So I focused on the Naval report.
Okay. Yeah.
It was like the first report.
Yes.
It was his report effectively to his funding agency saying, this is what I did with the money that you gave me. So I was like, if the goal of our podcast is to read the foundation, I focus most of what we're going to talk about today on that report. I also read the New York Times report, and there's a lot of overlap and like overlap of phrases, overlap of sentences between the New York Times report and the Naval report. But the New York Times report is much more salacious, much more edited for a non-psychological audience. Yeah.
As it should be.
So I will make reference to the New York Times article, but I didn't put a ton of that in.
Yes.
But it's out there. It was published April 8th, 1973. But we are focusing on the report in Naval Research Reviews. It really is so difficult to have a concrete idea of what to take away from the study, because Zimbardo made his entire career off of effectively the notoriety of this experiment.
Oh, right.
And if this experiment was done today, he would be run out of town. But this was done in the 70s, and he was frenemies effectively with Stanley Milgram.
Oh, okay.
Who did the shock study. So I think he was in like a competitive psychological research relationship with Milgram.
I remember one of our instructors, again, one of the times we talked about this, I remember one of them mentioning something about that, like putting them together in this mid-century field of social psychology, looking at kind of, I don't know, the dark side of human nature kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And that's part of Zimbardo's whole philosophy, is that everybody can do evil. Everybody has within them the capacity to do evil.
Yeah.
And he presents it in a really, how I interpret it, to be salacious. He presents it as like inside of you, even. Ooh, you could be evil. And I'm like, cool. Tell me more about how you like forced men to wear dresses with no underwear in front of each other. Like, great job.
Yeah.
Great psychology.
That is also the takeaway that I remember from this I was going to say article, but obviously we didn't read the article because evidently
it's not an article. Right.
Evidently that wasn't the thing, but that's the takeaway I remember. And I remember that being presented in a way that I found pretty compelling. The idea that on some level, it's not bad people do bad things. It's people under certain circumstances are more likely, regardless of who they are, to do bad things.
Yeah.
You know, that's the takeaway I got. I have no idea how well that's actually supported by the data, such as it is. But I remember that conclusion. I remember thinking that, I don't know.
Yeah. We'll get into it certainly throughout the episode. But the same way I swing wildly back and forth on how much Milgram's study matters or represents humanity or any of those things, a lot of the ideas that Zimbardo presents are not wrong. Right. Like the idea that prisons are places where atrocities happen, that we need prison reform. Right. Absolutely. Yes. Agree. But then his behaviors and the actions that he took very much present him as somebody that I would not trust the opinions of. Yeah. Right? That if you believed that your actions were reasonable actions, if you did these things, which he did, how can I trust your judgment? Mm-hmm. It's like poor judgment, right?
Yeah.
It's very confusing. It's very wild. Poor Jeff has been listening to me rant and rave of like Philip Zimbardo for weeks. So I'm sure he's very happy we're recording this and I can be done talking about a psychologist from 1971.
This is one of the big things about being an academic, though, is that it makes you totally insufferable to your partner. It's actually one of the features of being an academic. It's why you go into, you know, academia, is because you want your friends and family
to kind of dread being around you.
Yeah, every time you open your mouth, they just, you know, roll their eyes. Stop listening.
Sure, we're having a nice sandwich, but don't you know what Philip Zimbardo did in 1971?
Yeah.
And the answer is no, they do not know what Philip Zimbardo did in 1971. Nor do they care.
Yeah, no.
Which is fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is why we have to talk to each other about what Philip Zimbardo did in 1971.
Right. And this is why I have to find other nerds to talk about. About parliamentary procedure in my rhetoric society meetings.
Okay, someday we can have a bonus episode of parliamentary procedure in rhetoric societies. But for this episode, I have three stated goals.
Yes.
And the first goal is to read through the Naval article with you.
Terrific.
The second goal is to survive emotionally. I don't know if we're going to achieve this goal, but I'm just putting the goal.
That should really
out there.
Always be the goal.
Yeah. And the third goal is to not be sued or not be tweeted at. Or not have a retaliation article written about us. So that's my third
Very
goal.
Fair.
Yeah. So hopefully no one listens to this podcast, including Dr. Philip Zimbardo. So the article in the Naval Report is titled, A Study of Prisoners and Guards in a Simulated Prison. Mm-hmm. It was written by Craig Haney, Curtis Banks, and Philip Zimbardo from Stanford University, published in Naval Research Reviews, October 1973, and the study was sponsored by the Office of Naval Research, and it was designed, the original design of the study was to develop a better understanding of basic psychological mechanisms underlying human aggression. Where does human aggression come from? And the article in Naval Research Reports Reviews has a quote from the Navy, or a header from the Navy. So I'm going to read the header from the Navy. Quote, the Navy and Marine Corps have a direct interest in the conclusions drawn from the study, as much as parallels can be made between the forces which operated with Dr. Zimbardo's, quote, prison, and those which spawn disruptive interpersonal conflict in naval prisons. More importantly, this study identifies some of the conditions which are likely to promote unrest when men are placed in situations which demand close contact for protracted periods of time. Such research increases the Navy's capability to develop effective training designs to eliminate conditions which elicit counterproductive conflict.
Okay.
So the Navy wants to know, why do men fight with each other? Why do men on ships fight with each other? Why are men aggressive towards each other? And what can we do about it?
Okay.
So Zimbardo, he loves to quote literature. Mm. He's a very, very dramatic man. And the New York Times article was like every paragraph started with a reference to literature or a quote from literature from like everybody, right? Everyone who's ever written a book was quoted in the New York Times. So this article also starts with a quote from Dostoevsky. And Dostoevsky said, quote, if a man could withstand prison, he was a creature who could withstand anything. Because Dostoevsky was in Russian prison in the 1800s, which is like the worst place ever be. And Zimbardo says that prisons haven't changed that much overall, right? Prisons are prisons. There's a lot of similar mechanisms within prisons. But he said currently in 1973, the rhetoric of rehabilitation has replaced the language of punitive incarceration. The social institution of prison has continued to fail. So even though, even in the 70s, we were talking about how to rehabilitate people to enter them back into society instead of punishing people, prisons still fail. Mm. And this idea still fails.
Right. All right. So far I'm on board.
Yeah, exactly, right? It's like, yes, very good, very good conclusion.
A little Russian literature, a little prison abolition. Great. I think we can stop here and declare Zimbardo a hero.
No, he's not for abolishing prisons. Oh. He's for redesigning prisons.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's not abolishing.
Right, all right, so
yeah.
75% on board with old PZ. All right.
Mm-hmm. Zimbardo said that prisons aren't a deterrent against crime. They don't prevent people from doing crime. They don't rehabilitate people so that they're less likely to do crime in the future. And recidivism rates are over 75%. So if someone does a crime and then leaves prison, there's 75% likely to, or 75% of those people commit a crime again. And in 73, prisons cost Americans $1.5 billion annually. Wow. I was too sad to even look up what that would be in 2024. It would be like billions of billions and billions of dollars. And Zimbardo points out that prisons are horrible for the people receiving punishment as well as the people delivering the punishment, that everyone's soul is crushed in a prison. Our current understanding of prisons is a dispositional hypothesis that the state of prisons is because of the nature of people. Mm. So if we go back to nature versus nurture, prisons are the way they are because people end up in prison have innate characteristics, and people who are officers and have innate characteristics. And those people will always end up in prisons.
Yes.
Right? And there's these assumptions that prison guards are sadistic, uneducated, and insensitive people. Prison violence is the logical outcome of bringing together sadistic people with people who break social norms or prisoners. So people are in prison because they've broken the law. They've presumably broken the law that a society has decided on. So you are putting together in a confined space people who already break social norms.
So by nature, we're putting together disruptive people with sadists.
Yes, according to the dispositional hypothesis.
Right. Yeah. And so, okay. So that's the explanation for why prisons are bad places, according to the dispositional hypothesis.
Yeah, that's the current understanding of prisons is prisons will always be the way that they are because prisoners have innate characteristics, and prison guards have innate characteristics. And when you put those people together, the same thing will always happen.
So that hypothesis allows us to make some predictions about how the future will go. It's a theoretical framework in addition to just sort of a hypothesis. It also allows us to make predictions about the future.
Yeah.
Great.
And Zimbardo says that in this hypothesis, the public has to tolerate violence in prison because it's necessary to keep prisons functioning and to remove people who disregard society from society. So people have to allow prisoners to be on the receiving end of violence and force and control, because we have to remove them from society. They've broken the laws of society. So Zimbardo puts this question to us of, could prisons change? Could changing how a prison runs actually change anything about the prison itself, and about the environment, about the outcomes, that sort of thing? And he said that changing how a prison runs would be incredibly complex, incredibly expensive, and incredibly revolutionary, which are all true. And prisons work to remove people who agitate and protest and riot, and it's most likely that they will continue working just the way they have always worked. And again, this was 1971. I don't think that there's been any major prison reform since the 70s. I really couldn't think of anything, right?
I'm not an expert in this, but anecdotally, it seems like this sort of dispositional hypothesis still governs how a lot of people out in the world, if not people who run prisons, think these things operate.
Yeah. So the stated goal, Philip Zimbardo's stated goal to his funding agency, was he did the Stanford Prison Experiment to try to disprove the dispositional hypothesis. Okay. To try to disprove that prisons have to be like the prisons that we know of, and see, is there a different way to have a prison? So, quote, "The dispositional hypothesis cannot be critically evaluated directly through observation in existing prison settings." Okay. And he said, because people are already entrenched, people are already playing their roles, there's no way to know in a currently existing prison if nature or nurture has led people to behave the way that they're behaving. So that's why he had to, Martin, he had to set up this fake prison. And I don't even want to hear you argue, but it's the only way. It's the only way to answer this question.
Yeah.
I don't believe it's the only way. Zimbardo believes it's the only way. But, quote, "to separate the effects of the prison environment per se from those attributable to a priori dispositions of its inhabitants requires a research strategy in which a new prison is constructed comparable in its fundamental social psychological milieu to existing prison systems, but entirely populated by individuals who are undifferentiated in all essential dimensions from the rest of society." So he wants to build a prison that's exactly like a prison, but put, quote, "normal average." He says normal, normal average, normal people, normal white 20-year-old men.
That sounds average to me, yeah. Yeah, I
that's what he calls average, yeah. I spoiled, my favorite section of the podcast is where you guess who the subjects are. So I've spoiled that, but we can still pretend and you guess who,
who the subjects are. I did know that it was undergrads, and I was pretty sure that they were doing it for college credit, or for extra credit, so.
That's your stated
guess. That's my recollection.
And what's the number?
Oh, I want to say it was like, it was under, it might have been around a dozen, I think, is my recollection.
Okay.
Yeah. What is that? Maybe on par with the memory of car crashes, less than Milgram, way less than our favorite eugenicist, Dalton.
Our favorite eugenicist,
Fully 100 boys. That's...
So for this study, Zimbardo put an ad in a newspaper, and he called for respondents to his newspaper ad, and his ad called for people who were interested in earning $15 a day to study the conditions of a prison. Wow. And it was like a little like, whoop, do you want to earn money? Come be in a prison. And 75 people responded to the newspaper ad calling for male volunteers to participate in a psychological study of prison life. $15 a day in 1971 is about $115 a day. And because it's a 24-hour experiment, that's about $5 an hour in 2024
That's less
money.
Great.
And they screened for subjects who had no history of crime. And when they say no history of crime, they obviously mean no history of like caught.
No record.
No emotional disability, no physical handicaps, no intellectual or social disadvantages.
Oh.
What is that? That is horrible. Oh my God. So they're screening for rich people. They're screening for rich, right. Like,
so, yeah. To go back over this for just 1 second, I can see a train of logic that gets you here. If you're trying...
No.
If you're trying to disprove the dispositional hypothesis, you want a randomly selected group of people drawn from the general population, right?
But these aren't randomly selected.
Right. Exactly. But that is one way of approaching this problem. I don't know if it's the right best way to approach it, but that seems if I'm an undergraduate doing a psychology paper, that is the proposal I'm going to make, is that what we need is a random sample. That way we can eliminate the possibility that what happens in the prison is a product of people of a certain, who have a certain predisposition or a particular nature to them. Mm-hmm. All right. So that makes some amount of science-brained sense to me in terms of approaching the problem.
I want to apologize for myself in advance because this study and this whole situation has made me incredibly confrontational. Mm-hmm. So probably you're going to say something like, I agree with you. And I'll be like, no, you don't agree with me, because I'm primed to fight. Absolutely. Right now. So I'm going to fight.
And you should.
I'm very sorry
and
about
you
it.
You should.
But it's going to happen.
One of the things that I am primed to do after having taught a particular class this semester is to try to understand the reasoning behind absolute nonsense positions that people take. this is an assignment that I have students do throughout the semester, is like, let's figure out why people believe the ridiculous things they believe. Not so that we can be persuaded by them, just so that we can understand where they're coming from. So that's what I'm trying to do here. On some level, that makes sense. And I guess if it's 1971 and I, again, have been trained as a social psychologist who believes that there is no bias to putting an ad in the newspaper and that there's nothing inherently prejudicial about saying, don't have a criminal record, don't have any documented psychological or physical disabilities, don't
have social disadvantages. Right.
Yes. And if I'm a certain kind of social psychology brained person, I can see that and say, yeah, I did a random sample. So, okay. I get how we got here. It's not good, but I get how we got here.
Okay. So they gave there were 22 subjects. Ooh. Selected from the 75 okay. respondents. So we're at 22 Great. Subjects. And these subjects filled out questionnaires for physical health, mental health, what crimes they had done, mm-hmm. if they had any psychopathology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. 24 subjects who were, quote, the most stable, sure. mature physically and mm-hmm. mentally, and least antisocial mm-hmm. were asked to participate.
Do we get a bunch of data on how they made those determinations?
Absolutely not. Of course not. Zimbardo made the determinations, and that should be good enough for you. Why are you questioning this?
Is this where we're going to get an angry tweet that says, on page 593 of The Loser Effect?
Yes, absolutely. That book is 600 pages long. 600. It's insane. But the subjects were, quote, normal, healthy, male college students who were in the Stanford area during Great. The summer. So that's our population we're Perfect. Working with. They were middle uh-huh. class. They were uh-huh. Caucasian with one, I'm going to say Asian. Uh-huh. Zimbardo does not say Asian. He says what is now a slur. So I am not going to say the slur. And all of the subjects were strangers to each other, so they didn't come into the prison with pre-existing relationships okay. to All each right. other. There were 10 prisoners and 11 guards, and the guards were on 8-hour shifts, and the prisoners were in the prison for 24 hours a day. And now let's get to our Ooh. Ethics.
Okay. Oh, they're
a really good,
terrific.
Good and solid. Yeah, really good. Quote, For ethical, moral, and pragmatic reasons, we could not detain our subjects for an extended or indefinite period of time. We could not exercise the threat or promise of severe physical punishment. We could not allow homosexual or racist practices to flourish.
Wait, what?
They could not allow it because they're so ethical. Nor
no, those seem actually pretty equivalent. yeah, homosexual and racist practices are ethically equivalent, I think.
Ethically yeah. equivalent, yeah. No homosexual practices.
Great.
as a spoiler alert for this article, Zimbardo uses homosexual interchangeable with rape, with forcible sexual rape.
Got like it.
When he says what homosexual, what he means is sexual violence. Yeah.
Wow.
Is like male on male sexual violence. Yes. So when he says homosexual or racist practices, he means sexual violence or racist practices. I believe that's my interpretation, yes. But he says homosexual. Right. Nor could we duplicate certain other aspects of prisoner life. And he also says, in terms of the hypothesis, that no specific hypotheses were gathered other than the general one, that the assignment to the treatment of guard or prisoner would result in significantly different reactions on behavioral measures of interaction, emotional measures of mood, state, and pathology, attitudes towards the self, as well as other indices of coping and adaptation to this novel situation. Right. So the only variable they had was the assignment of either guard or prisoner. And the experiment lasted 4 days. It was originally scheduled to last for 2 weeks, but everything was a fucking disaster. And it was called after 4 days.
I kind of remember that from the documentary as well.
The lore of how the study came into being, the first wave of the lore is that Zimbardo did this. And the second wave of the lore is that Zimbardo was teaching a class at Stanford University, a psychology class, and one of his students came up to him, and the student had run, I believe, a mock prison environment and told Zimbardo about it. And Zimbardo said, "That's the best thing I've ever heard in my life. Let's do this immediately."
Okay, so when I said this is a line of reasoning that makes total sense if you're an undergraduate in a psychology class, that actually tracks
with what happened.
Probably happened here.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it gets so bonkers because the Lucifer Effect is 600 pages long, right? And I read the tidbit about Zimbardo teaching the psychology class and the student coming up to Zimbardo and saying, "Hey, I did this really cool thing." And then Zimbardo had the student help him set up the Stanford Prison Experiment. One of the criticisms of the Stanford Prison Experiment papers I read criticized Zimbardo for pretending that he himself came up with the Stanford Prison Experiment when actually it was so similar to the student's experiment. But in these early reports, Zimbardo doesn't mention the previous experiment, right? He doesn't mention the student's experiment. He says, "I did this." But in The Lucifer Effect, the book that you can buy, that you can give Philip Zimbardo money to read, he mentions this. So it became this, like, you know the scene from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia where Charlie's working for the Mail and he has all the red yarn on the wall connecting this to that, to that, to that, to that. That's what I was doing because I was like, people are saying he's lying. He didn't lie. He just has published so much that he's put different pieces of information in different publications. Right. Some of it you have to pay for. Some of it you have to find naval reports from 1973.
Some you have to enroll in Stanford University.
Some you have to enroll in Stanford University. It's like insane the amount that he has produced about 4 days in 1971 is insane.
Is it possible that the reason he didn't initially report that he got this from a student is because he didn't want to be a narc? He didn't want this student who set up a prison to go to be sent to real prison because
No, the student worked with him on the Stanford Prison Experiment.
But we've kind of skipped over the fact that some student, okay, Christina, you're a teacher. So you're teaching a class and a student comes up to you and says, hey, so a while ago I set up a prison. I imprisoned several people for up to 2 weeks of time. And then I observed what happened. What is your response to that? Is your response, hey, that seems like a good idea? Or is your response, hey, cool, hang out here for a minute. I have to make a call. Because...
Yeah, and I would call the Navy and I would say, clear your next journal. Have I got the article for you? I'd call the Marine Corps and the Navy and I would have them fight against each other to drive up the price of this article. Yeah, bidding war.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, cool. So you're on Zimbardo's side here.
Don't you even. No, in real life, I would be like, are you playing D&D right now? Are you like LARPing? Am I being LARPed at?
LARPed at. Which I think is a Title IX violation. To be LARPed at on a college campus. To be LARPed at,
yes. Oh my God. So... they have this study. They have the student who previously did the study version one, right? They also have a consultant who had previously been in prison for 16 years. And he has gone on and given a ton of interviews, talked about this a lot. But he helped them design the prison to be the most prison-like possible.
Wow, okay.
And their study had two dependent measures. So the independent variable, mm-hmm. the treatment variable, was whether the subject was assigned to be a guard
yes.
or assigned to be a prisoner.
Right.
And the dependent measures were the transactions between the subjects, between the guard and the prisoners,
mm-hmm.
and the individual reactions on questionnaires, on writing, on interviews, etc.
What do they mean by transactions?
They mean like interactions, how they talked to each other, how they touched each other, how they treated each other.
Okay.
The words they used towards each other.
And so they are presumably going to do some kind of qualitative analysis of various types of interaction between these people.
Yes.
Great.
And there were cameras.
That's right.
I'll get more into the design
Great.
When we talk about the methods. But yeah, there's a whole bunch of ways that they... tracked that.
Okay.
So the prison itself mm-hmm. was a 35-foot basement corridor
uh-huh.
in the psychology building of Stanford University.
Mm-hmm.
It had three small cells, three prisoner cells.
Uh-huh.
It had an observation screen. It had steel-barred doors.
Oh, wow.
And all the furniture was removed. There was a cot for each prisoner to sleep on.
Uh-huh.
And there was also a small closet that they used for solitary confinement that was 2 feet by 2 feet by 7 feet.
Whoa.
So very, very small.
Whoa.
There was also an observation room where Philip Zimbardo and assistants could watch. There was a warden room and a superintendent room. The warden room was one of the other psychology researchers working on this project. Philip Zimbardo himself was the superintendent.
Okay.
So he played like... in a play, like in a stage production,
yeah.
he played the superintendent of this prison.
Okay.
And there's also a guard relaxation room.
Oh, okay.
The prisoners, so the 10 prisoners were in the prison for 24 hours a day. Three were in a cell each day, and I don't know where the rest were, because there were three cells.
Yeah, three per cell.
I think it was three per cell. The numbers get a little fuzzy sometimes,
right.
but don't worry. People start dropping out really fast, so the numbers fluctuate.
That's always a sign of a good study, too, when
yeah.
when the numbers don't add up. three times three is 11?
Yeah, so there was like one on standby.
Oh, no, that's right.
That's
right. There were 10 prisoners and 11 guards, right?
10 prisoners, 11 guards.
Right,
yeah.
right.
So,
right. so there's,
nine,
there's one unaccounted for.
I think in solitary confinement the whole time. There's one that got stuck in solitary confinement.
Oh, my God.
But yeah, this paper has no graphs. It has no charts. It has none of that. It's like a
right.
novel. It's written in novel style,
wow.
basically. So it's really hard to like track
right.
things. But we're just moving on.
Right.
We're just,
Don't worry about that.
We're moving on. So the guards worked 8-hour shifts, but some of the guards worked longer shifts, showed up earlier, stayed later, because they just loved being guards so much.
Whoa.
And they had to agree, all the participants had to agree ahead of time that they would be either a guard or a prisoner. They weren't told which one they were going to be. But to be in the study, they had to say, yes, I will be a guard or a prisoner. And they had to be available for 2 weeks.
Yes.
And they had to sign a contract. I would pay real money to have a lawyer look at this contract and say, holy fuck, this is not enforceable. They signed a contract guaranteeing that they would receive minimally adequate diet, clothing, housing, and medical care in return for their stated intention of serving in the assigned role for the duration of the study. So they were signing this thing saying, I agree that I will get adequate food, clothing, shelter.
Right.
And quote, prisoners should expect to be under surveillance and to have some of their basic civil rights suspended during their imprisonment, excluding physical abuse.
Okay.
Can you sign away your civil rights? Can you sign a contract saying, I give up my civil rights?
I don't know. I'll tell you, I've never had need to find that out. I will say that, yeah, I have not been in a situation where I have drawn up a contract asking people to forego their civil rights and then had a lawyer review it.
Yeah, that's probably, we should do that. Once we start making real money on this podcast, we should get a lawyer and sign away our civil rights.
Yeah, yeah. This sounds a lot like, did you ever read that article about the libertarian town in New Hampshire where they got overrun by bears? Yes. Like that's like the libertarian dream is like, I can sign
away. To be overrun by bears.
Well, to be able to sign away your civil rights and have no one bother you about it so that you can, yes, be overrun by bears.
The thing that made me sad was the same thing that makes me sad in general is no one reads anything, because the headline of that article was town gets overrun by bears. And if you read the article, it's like 2 bear attacks over 3 years or something like
Which is way more than they had before.
But they don't report that. They don't report the data. They don't show me a chart of bear attacks. Oh,
bear attacks? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think this is sensationalist reporting. Mm-hmm. Yep. But
right.
I do love the dream of libertarians being eaten by bears because they won't clean up their own garbage.
Right. Yeah. You have the right to sign away your own civil rights and to be eaten by a bear.
To be eaten by a bear.
Yeah.
So all of the participants were told to be in their house on a Sunday. The experiment started on a Sunday.
Okay.
So the guards met with the superintendent, who was Philip Zimbardo. Mm-hmm. The paper in the Naval Review has 3 authors on it, but everything is written from Philip Zimbardo's point of view. So he said the guards met the superintendent, parentheses, the author. But dude, there's 3 authors. Which author?
Amazing.
So just poor writing, egomaniac writing, but whatever. An undergraduate research assistant played the warden, and I believe that this is the person who originally did the Stanford prison experiment. But Philip Zimbardo was the superintendent, and I believe he was 40 at the time of this experiment with a 20-year-old warden. Great.
Oh, just thinking about all of the times I've worked with undergraduate research assistants. Or like,
would you trust any of them to be the warden in your prison?
Or the times when I was an undergraduate research assistant. First of all, I was a weird undergrad, so.
You're kidding me.
Unlike you, I was an undergrad until I was nearly 30. But even still, like, yeah, thinking about like the level of responsibility I had was pretty minimal. It was like I was given the permission to write the ad to hire participants. But even
20 normal, rich, white.
I was going to say, even then, it was edited by someone else before it went out. And then I was like given license to like run the experiment. But again, every step of it was this is a shocking amount of responsibility given to an undergrad research assistant.
To pretend to be a warden, yeah.
That's.
But he already had experience. He had specific simulated prison experience. He could put on his resume, have you run in a simulated prison, yes or no? He could vehemently circle yes.
Which,
yes, I have.
Which, if you ask me, is disqualifying. Have you ever recreationally run a prison? Okay, we want nothing more to do with you. Please see yourself out.
And the guards, the people who were assigned to be the guards, the subjects who were assigned to be the guards, were told that the study wanted to simulate a prison environment within limits imposed by ethical and pragmatic considerations.
Right.
Their task was to maintain a reasonable degree of order within the prison necessary for its effective functioning. And the task was to prepare for anything the prisoners might do and to respond to it. Mm. And the guards did all of the setup of the experiment. Okay. So they did the physical labor of moving all the old furniture out, moving the cots in place, putting up the signs, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an area of controversy. I'm going to try to just highlight some areas of controversy as we just like plow the way through the journal. But part of the controversy about this experiment is how much did Zimbardo prime the guards to behave like guards? How much did he give them instructions on how guards behave?
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
How much did he like give them their roles, describe to them the role that they should play?
Right.
Versus just telling them, you're a guard in a prison, do whatever.
Right.
Do whatever you want to do. You're a guard.
Right.
So the guards believed that we, Zimbardo and team, were primarily interested in studying the behavior of the prisoners. And I don't believe that for a second, because the guards also filled out surveys, filled out diaries, mm-hmm. kept track of things.
Right.
But that's what Zimbardo said.
Right.
And the guards were, quote, intentionally given only minimal guidelines for what it meant to be a guard. That's been really hotly contested over the decades.
Interesting.
The guards were prohibited from physical punishment and physical aggression,
mm-hmm.
but they absolutely did physical punishment and physical aggression.
Oh, wow.
So it becomes, what was Zimbardo doing as the superintendent? What was our 20-year-old doing as the warden?
Right.
If the guards were breaking the physical punishment, physical aggression rules.
Right.
And now we get to dress up.
Ooh.
We get to play dress up.
Oh, wow. No gray lab coats, I imagine.
No gray lab coats. No, no, no. Both the guards and the prisoners had uniforms. The guards had khaki shirts, trousers, a whistle, a police nightstick, a wooden baton, reflecting sunglasses to prevent eye contact with the prisoners. So I think they looked like Top Gun.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm picturing Top Gun.
I was picturing Frank Poncherello from Chips.
I don't know what that is. I don't know what that is.
You don't know the show Chips?
I don't know the show Chips. Is it about a simulated prison environment?
It's about California Highway Patrol.
Oh, is it like a precursor to Police Academy? How similar? What's the Venn diagram of Chips and Police Academy? I'm assuming it's just a circle, completely overlapping.
Yeah, yeah. Chips prominently featured a guy who did sound effects with his mouth. Yeah, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Michael Winslow was all over that. I think that's the name of the sound effects guy.
You can edit it in post if it's different.
Yeah, yeah. Chips was just like a cop show, but it was not like Law and Order, because Law and Order is from the 90s, and in the 90s everything was about being gritty. Chips is from the 70s and 80s, so it was mostly just about how hot Officer Frank Poncherello was in his very, very tight motorcycle cop outfit
and his sunglasses.
Yep, and his amazing 70s hair.
And then the prisoners also had a uniform.
Mm-hmm.
The prisoners wore a loose-fitting muslin smock with an ID number on the front and back. They had no underwear. Mm. They had a light chain and lock around one ankle. Oh, wow. That was on 24 hours a day.
Wow.
They had rubber sandals and they had a cap made from nylon stocking.
Oh.
So they were wearing, Zimbardo throughout the article really makes it a point to emphasize how feminized the prisoners were.
Okay.
Because they were wearing dresses. They were wearing dresses with no underwear. How feminine, how emasculating and sissifying these uniforms were to the prisoners.
Sure.
Yeah, and no personal items were allowed, so all the prisoners were given a toothbrush, soap, soap dish, towel, and linen.
Uh-huh.
And items were meant to make the guards feel very powerful and make the prisoners feel very de-individualized and very meek. The hat was to cover their hair, so there would be no differentiation based on hair. It would only be numbers, so like short hair versus long hair versus curly hair, none of that. The hat was to cover that.
Interesting.
And quote directly from the article, the ill-fitting uniforms made the prisoners feel awkward in their movements since these dresses were worn without undergarments. The uniforms forced them to assume unfamiliar positions, more like those of a woman than a man, another part of the emasculating process of becoming a prisoner.
Sure.
Whatever you say, Dr. Phillips and Bernard.
I'm just not sure where this prisoner and emasculation thing came from. I'm assuming there's no literature review here where he is drawing, or the authors are drawing on like a rich literature of.
There certainly is emasculation in prisons, right? That's certainly a huge part of control, is to make men feel emasculated when they are not choosing to feel emasculated.
Okay, all right.
And part of the background, Zimbardo says that he had hundreds of hours of interviews with prisoners and consultations with guards at prisons. So his whole stated goal was to make this as realistic as possible.
Got it, okay.
And we know from further prison study, the very little that I know about prisons is that sexual violence is a huge tool within prisons. It's like very pronounced and very present.
I see. Okay.
So it doesn't surprise me that Zimbardo took out emasculating features as inherent quality of prisons.
An important part of that realism. It was
an important part of realism.
Got it. Okay.
But the question becomes, how much of the setup is because of nature, of the nature of the people who set up the prisons? And if you were trying to study a prison, why would you set it up in a way that has already been predetermined?
Exactly. Yeah.
To exist in the way that was chosen by people who are sadistic, right?
Yes.
Yeah. The stated goal of changing prisons, prison reform, is at the heart of everything.
Right.
So you start like arguing the psychology of it. And then you come back to, oh, but I agree that prisons are a terrible place where terrible things happen and they should be changed.
Right.
And I think the huge disconnect is that Zimbardo thought that this was the correct route forward to study an actual phenomenon of the violence, including sexual violence, that occurs within prisons.
Right. Yeah. A lot of this seems to be working at cross purposes with his stated goal. And it's a little confusing why you would complicate it in these ways.
Why you would set it up in the way that it has previously been set up by the people that you are trying to avoid.
Right.
Right.
Yes. No, exactly. Yeah. You're muddling what could have been a very clean design. He says that he's just taking something that you could squint and be an undergrad and think is a random sample, and then randomly assigning to one of two groups. And this is the independent variable, is that you're randomly assigned to these two conditions. That's all very simple. And then you're measuring what result there is. If you leave it at that, I think it's still monstrous and unethical. And I have a lot of questions about a lot of elements of this, but at least it's simple. But now he's but now he's adding all these complications that are actually muddling those variables.
Yeah, and if the fundamental question is about control or if the fundamental question is about violence, yes. It doesn't have to be in a prison environment. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes.
It can be
yes.
in other environments.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. He's
If the Navy is funding this because right. they're interested yes. in interpersonal relationships yes. within the Navy, yes. then study interpersonal relationships within right. the Navy. Why are you building
right.
a fake prison? I was also thinking about like fraternities. We know that hazing yes. as a huge element of control. Yes. has a lot yes. of the same beats yes. of forced emasculation, of sissification, of sexual violence,
absolutely.
Of physical violence, yes. right? So I come back to the same point of what was he thinking over and over and over again? Mm-hmm. Why did he do this?
Right.
So, we're moving forward. We're going to get through this. So, how were they actually inducted into the study? So, everyone who agreed to participate in the study, who was assigned to be a prisoner, was arrested in their home, Ooh. Was spread-eagled across the back of a police car at their house in front of their neighbors and their family, was thoroughly searched.
What?
They were handcuffed. They were charged with suspicion of burglary or armed robbery. They were driven in a police car to a police station where they were fingerprinted. They had an ID file What? Prepared and they were placed in a cell in a prison. And then following being placed in a cell, they were blindfolded and driven to Stanford University.
Wow.
So the police officers, the real life police officers, the real Palo Alto Right. City Police Department Yeah. didn't answer any questions for these research participants if this was in relation to the prison study.
Oh, wow.
So these people were forcibly abducted from their homes, were searched, were thrown across cop cars.
Right.
Were humiliated in front of their family, in front of their friends, in front of their
wow.
neighbors. And then were placed into the prison. At Stanford, they were stripped completely naked. They were sprayed with a delousing spray, the same that happens when people uh-huh. enter prison.
Wow.
They were made to stand alone and naked in the cell yard, and then they were sent to the cell.
Wow.
So immediately you have psychological trauma.
Right.
Like absolutely 100%. You are like absolutely abducting yeah. 20-year-old men. You're stripping them, you're placing them in a cell yard, you're embarrassing them in front of their family,
yeah.
in front of their neighborhood where they live. They have to go back to the neighborhood.
Right.
And that's just to physically get them to the prison.
Right.
That has nothing to do with the prison environment. That's the arresting procedure, right?
Right.
So weird.
Yet another complication we're adding for no good reason?
Yeah. Because if it's a prison environment,
right.
that's separate from arresting. Right. Like arresting could be the trigger that leads to the learned helplessness,
right.
like PTSD, yeah. emotional scarring, depression, that
right.
sort of thing.
Yeah.
Once the prisoners were in the prison, the warden, the 20-year-old research assistant, I'm making up that he was 20. I don't remember how old he was when this study happened, but he was a student at Stanford University. Do you remember in BoJack Horseman, Vincent Adult Man? Whenever I read about the warden in these studies, I just pictured Vincent Adult Man. So the warden, parentheses, Vincent Adult Man,
oh
greeted the prisoners and read them the rules of the institution that were decided by the guards. The guards designed what they wanted the rules to be.
Oh, wow.
The prisoners were referred to only by their number. Mm-hmm. They had 3 meals a day. They had 3 supervised toilet visits. They had 2 hours for letter writing or reading, daily work assignments, 2 visiting periods per week where they could visit with their family. They had movie nights and they had exercise periods. And 3 times a day, the prisoners were lined up for the count, where the guards like counted all the prisoners and made the prisoners recite back the rules of the institution. On the first day, this was a 10-minute procedure,
but
the guards became...
How could that take 10 minutes? There's only 10 of them.
There were 16 rules.
Oh, I see.
They had to recite the rules based on whatever number the guard picked for them to recite.
Okay, all right.
This started at 10 minutes, and then later on days three and days four, it lasted for hours as it became like a tool
hours
of control that the guards used over the prisoners.
I see. Wow. Okay. I was shocked at 10 minutes, but it really...
Hours. Wow.
Okay.
Hours, yeah. So now we're to the results. We've made it to the results of this study.
Okay. All right. So far, we have these people who have been abducted. They've been assaulted, I guess is the right word for it. Although they signed a totally non-binding waiver that said this is
totally
legit.
Totally binding and legal. That's, waiving of their civil rights.
We don't know if it's binding, so that's a joke, obviously. Don't sue us. But they signed this waiver. They were sort of... Yeah, tormented. And then they had this daily schedule that was pretty rigidly assigned to them that after 3 days had turned into multiple hours of recitation of their number and a bunch of arbitrary rules that the guards came up with.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just videotaped all of this. And that was the study?
That was the study. That's our data.
Okay. All right. Yeah, this is the point where I would expect to see some graphs or something, but cool. No.
No graphs. Okay. Not a single graph.
Got it. All right, moving on then.
Okay, so that's everything up through the results.
Okay, so we've set the scene. Hey, Christina.
Hey, Martin.
Have you ever been in the midst of a podcast episode that you were pretty sure was going to take 9 hours and thought that maybe you should split it into two parts?
I think to achieve our second stated goal.
Yeah.
Of not going insane and not having people who listen to this go insane.
Right.
We should maybe split this up into two exciting episodes where we have a cliffhanger.
Oh, okay.
Where people wonder what the results of this very well designed, very well reported, very logical and coherent study work.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Another part of the cliffhanger will be after we release it, people can be at home wondering if we got a cease and desist and had to not do the second half.
They can check Twitter, see what Philip Zimbardo is up to on Twitter.
Terrific. All right. Well, yeah, let's
join us next week for the exciting conclusion of the Stanford Prison Experiment.